dream of mine.
Crossing the bridge, he gazed quietly and calmly at the Neva, at the glowing red sun setting in the glowing sky. In spite of his weakness, he was not conscious of fatigue. It was as though an abscess that had been forming for a month past in his heart had suddenly broken. Freedom! Freedom! He was free from that spell, that sorcery, that obsession. Later on, when he recalled that time, and all that happened to him during those days, minute by minute, point by point, he was superstitiously impressed by one circumstance, which, though in itself not very exceptional, always seemed to him afterwards the predestined turning point of his fate. He could never understand and explain to himself why, when he was tired and worn out, when it would have been more convenient for him to go home by the shortest and most direct way, he had returned by the Haymarket, where he had no need to go. It was obviously and quite unnecessarily out of his way, though not much so. It's true that it happened to him dozens of times to return home without noticing what streets he passed through, but why, he was always asking himself, why had such an important, such a decisive, and at the same time such an absolutely chance meeting happened in the Haymarket, where he had moreover no reason to go, at the very hour, the very minute of his life, when he was just in the very mood and in the very circumstances in which that meeting was able to exert the gravest and most decisive influence on his whole destiny. As though it had been lying in wait for him on purpose. It was about 9 o'clock when he crossed the Haymarket. At the tables and the barrows, at the booths and the shops, all the market people were closing their establishments or clearing away and packing up their wares, and, like their customers, were going home. Rag-pickers and fruit-sellers of all kinds were crowding round the taverns in the dirty and stinking courtyards of the Haymarket. Raskolnikov particularly liked this place and the neighboring alleys when he wandered aimlessly in the streets. Here, his rags did not attract contemptuous attention, and one could walk about in any attire without scandalizing people. At the corner of an alley, a huckster and his wife had two tables set out with tapes, thread, cotton handkerchiefs, etc. They, too, had got up to go home, but were lingering in conversation with a friend who had just come up to them. This friend was Lizaveta Ivanovna, or, as everyone called her, Lizaveta, the younger sister of the old pawnbroker Alyona Ivanovna, whom Raskolnikov had visited the previous day to pawn his watch and make his experiment. He already knew all about Lizaveta, and she knew him a little too. She was a single woman of about 35, tall, clumsy, timid, submissive, and almost idiotic. She was a complete slave, and went in fear and trembling of her sister, who made her work day and night, and even beat her. She was standing with a bundle before the huckster and his wife, listening earnestly and doubtfully. They were talking of something with special warmth. The moment Raskolnikov caught sight of her, he was overcome by a strange sensation, as it were, of intense astonishment, though there was nothing astonishing about this meeting.
"You could make up your mind for yourself, Lizaveta Ivanovna," the huckster was saying aloud. "Come round tomorrow, about 7. They will be here too."
"Tomorrow?" said Lizaveta slowly and thoughtfully, as though unable to make up her mind.
"Upon my word, how afraid you are of Alyona Ivanovna," gabbled the huckster's wife, a lively little woman. "I look at you, you are like some little babe. And she is not your own sister either, nothing but a stepsister, and what a hand she keeps over you.
But this time don't say a word to Alyona Ivanovna, her husband interrupted. That's my advice. But come round to us without asking. It will be worth your while. Later on your sister herself may have a notion.
Shall I?
About 7 o'clock tomorrow, and they will be here. You will be able to decide for yourself.
And we'll have a cup of tea, added his wife. All right. I'll come, said Lizaveta, still pondering. And she began slowly moving away.
Raskolnikov had just passed and heard no more. He passed softly, unnoticed, trying not to miss a word. His first amazement was followed by a thrill of horror, like a shiver running down his spine. He had learned. He had suddenly, quite unexpectedly learned, that the next day at 7 o'clock, Lizaveta, the old woman's sister and only companion, would be away from home, and that therefore at 7 o'clock precisely, the old woman would be left alone. He was only a few steps from his lodging. He went in like a man condemned to death. He thought of nothing, and was incapable of thinking. But he felt suddenly in his whole being that he had no more freedom of thought, no will, and that everything was suddenly and irrevocably decided. Certainly, if he had to wait whole years for a suitable opportunity, he could not reckon on a more certain step towards the success of the plan than that which had just presented itself. In any case, it would have been difficult to find out beforehand, and with certainty, with greater exactness and less risk, and without dangerous inquiries and investigations, that next day, at a certain time, an old woman, on whose life an attempt was contemplated, would be at home, and entirely alone.
Chapter 6
Later on, Raskolnikov happened to find out why the huckster and his wife had invited Lizaveta. It was a very ordinary matter, and there was nothing exceptional about it. A family, who had come to the town and been reduced to poverty, were selling their household goods and clothes, all women's things. As the things would have fetched little in the market, they were looking for a dealer. This was Lizaveta's business. She undertook such jobs and was frequently employed, as she was very honest, and always fixed a fair price and stuck to it. She spoke, as a rule, little, and, as we have said already, she was very submissive and timid. But Raskolnikov had become superstitious of late. The traces of superstition remained in him long after, and were almost ineradicable. And in all this, he was always afterwards disposed to see something strange and mysterious, as it were the presence of some peculiar influences and coincidences. In the previous winter, a student he knew, called Prokhoryev, who had left for Kharkov, had chanced in conversation to give him the address of Alyona Ivanovna, the old pawnbroker, in case he might want to pawn anything. For a long while, he didn't go to her, for he had lessons and managed to get along somehow. 6 weeks ago, he had remembered the address. He had two articles that could be pawned, his father's old silver watch, and a little gold ring with three red stones, a present from his sister at parting. He decided to take the ring. When he found the old woman, he had felt an insurmountable repulsion for her at the first glance, though he knew nothing special about her. He got 2 rubles from her and went into a miserable little tavern on his way home. He asked for tea, sat down, and sank into deep thought. A strange idea was pecking at his brain like a chicken in the egg, and very, very much absorbed him. Almost beside him at the next table, there was sitting a student whom he didn't know and had never seen, and with him a young officer. They had played a game of billiards and began drinking tea. All at once, he heard the student mention to the officer the pawnbroker Alyona Ivanovna, and give him her address. This of itself seemed strange to Raskolnikov. He had just come from her, and here at once he heard her name. Of course it was a chance, but he could not shake off a very extraordinary impression. And here someone seemed to be speaking expressly for him. The student began telling his friend various details about Alyona Ivanovna.
"She is first rate," he said. "You can always get money from her. She's as rich as a Jew. She can give you 5,000 rubles at a time, and she's not above taking a pledge for a ruble. Lots of our fellows have had dealings with her. But she's an awful old harpy."
And he began describing how spiteful and uncertain she was. How if you were only a day late with your interest, the pledge was lost. How she gave a quarter of the value of an article, and took 5 and even 7% a month on it, and so on. The student chattered on, saying that she had a sister, Lizaveta, whom the wretched little creature was continually beating and kept in complete bondage like a small child, though Lizaveta was at least 6 feet high.
"There's a phenomenon for you," cried the student, and he laughed.
They began talking about Lizaveta. The student spoke about her with a peculiar relish and was continually laughing, and the officer listened with great interest and asked him to send Lizaveta to do some mending for him. Raskolnikov did not miss a word and learned everything about her. Lizaveta was younger than the old woman and was her half-sister, being the child of a different mother. She was 35. She worked day and night for her sister, and besides doing the cooking and the washing, she did sewing, and worked as a charwoman, and gave her sister all she earned. She didn't dare to accept an order or job of any kind without her sister's permission. The old woman had already made her will, and Lizaveta knew of it, and by this will she would not get a farthing. Nothing but the movables, chairs, and so on. All the money was left to a monastery in the province of N. that prayers might be said for her in perpetuity. Lizaveta was of lower rank than her sister, unmarried, and awfully uncouth in appearance, remarkably tall, with long feet that looked as if they were bent outwards. She always wore battered goatskin shoes, and was clean in her person. What the student expressed most surprise and amusement about was the fact that Lizaveta was continually with child.
"But you say she is hideous," observed the officer. "Yes, she's so dark-skinned and looks like a soldier dressed up. But you know, she's not at all hideous. She has such a good-natured face and eyes, strikingly so, and the proof of it is that lots of people are attracted by her. She's such a soft, gentle creature, ready to put up with anything, always willing, willing to do anything. And her smile is really very sweet."
"You seem to find her attractive yourself," laughed the officer.
"From her queerness. No, I'll tell you what. I could kill that damn old woman and make off with her money, I assure you, without the faintest conscience prick," the student added with warmth. The officer laughed again, while Raskolnikov shuddered. How strange it was. "Listen, I want to ask you a serious question," the student said hotly. "I was joking, of course, but look here. On one side, we have a stupid, senseless, worthless, spiteful, ailing, horrid old woman, not simply useless, but doing actual mischief, who has not an idea what she is living for herself, and who will die in a day or two in any case. You understand? You understand?"
"Yes, yes, I understand," answered the officer, watching his excited companion attentively.
"Well, listen, then. On the other side, fresh young lives thrown away for want of help, and by thousands on every side.
100,000 good deeds could be done and helped on that old woman's money, which will be buried in a monastery. Hundreds, thousands, perhaps, might be set on the right path. Dozens of families saved from destitution, from ruin, from vice, from the Locke hospitals, and all with her money. Kill her. Take her money. And with the help of it, devote oneself to the service of humanity and the good of all. What do you think? Would not one tiny crime be wiped out by thousands of good deeds? For one life, thousands would be saved from corruption and decay. One death, and 100 lives in exchange. It's simple arithmetic. Besides, what value has the life of that sickly, stupid, ill-natured old woman in the balance of existence? No more than the life of a louse, of a black beetle. Less, in fact, because the old woman is doing harm. She is wearing out the lives of others. The other day she bit Lizaveta's finger out of spite. It almost had to be amputated.
Of course, she doesn't deserve to live, remarked the officer. But there it is, it's nature.
Ah, well, brother, but we have to correct and direct nature. And, but for that, we should drown in an ocean of prejudice. But for that there would never have been a single great man. They talk of duty, conscience. I don't want to say anything against duty and conscience, but the point is, what do we mean by them? Stay, I have another question to ask you. Listen.
No, you stay. I'll ask you a question. Listen.
Well?
You are talking and speechifying away, but tell me, would you kill the old woman yourself?
Of course not. I was only arguing the justice of it. It's nothing to do with me.
But I think if you wouldn't do it yourself, there's no justice about it. Let us have another game. Raskolnikov was violently agitated. Of course, it was all ordinary youthful talk and thought, such as he had often heard before, in different forms and on different themes. But why had he happened to hear such a discussion and such ideas at the very moment when his own brain was just conceiving the very same ideas? And why, just at the moment when he had brought away the embryo of his idea from the old woman, had he dropped at once upon a conversation about her? This coincidence always seemed strange to him. This trivial talk in a tavern had an immense influence on him in his later action, as though there had really been in it something preordained, some guiding hint. On returning from the Haymarket, he flung himself on the sofa and sat for a whole hour without stirring. Meanwhile, it got dark. He had no candle, and, indeed, it didn't occur to him to light up. He could never recollect whether he had been thinking about anything at that time. At last, he was conscious of his former fever and shivering, and he realized with relief that he could lie down on the sofa. Soon, heavy, leaden sleep came over him, as it were crushing him. He slept an extraordinarily long time, and without dreaming. Nastasya, coming into his room at 10 o'clock the next morning, had difficulty in rousing him. She brought him in tea and bread. The tea was again the second brew, and again in her own teapot.
"My goodness, how he sleeps!" she cried indignantly. "And he is always asleep!"
He got up with an effort. His head ached. He stood up, took a turn in his garret, and sank back on the sofa again.
"Going to sleep again," cried Nastasya. "Are you ill, eh?"
He made no reply.
"Do you want some tea?"
"Afterwards,"
he said with an effort, closing his eyes again and turning to the wall. Nastasya stood over him. "Perhaps he really is ill," she said, turned and went out. She came in again at 2 o'clock with soup. He was lying as before. The tea stood untouched. Nastasya felt positively offended, and began wrathfully rousing him. "Why are you lying like a log?" she shouted, looking at him with repulsion. He got up and sat down again, but said nothing and stared at the floor. "Are you ill or not?" asked Nastasya, and again received no answer. "You'd better go out and get a breath of air," she said after a pause. "Will you eat it or not?"
"Afterwards," he said weakly, "you can go."
And he motioned her out. She remained a little longer, looked at him with compassion, and went out. A few minutes afterwards, he raised his eyes and looked for a long while at the tea and the soup. Then he took the bread, took up a spoon, and began to eat. He ate a little, 3 or 4 spoonfuls, without appetite, as it were mechanically. His head ached less. After his meal, he stretched himself on the sofa again, but now he couldn't sleep. He lay without stirring, with his face in the pillow. He was haunted by daydreams, and such strange daydreams. In one that kept recurring, he fancied that he was in Africa, in Egypt, in some sort of oasis. The caravan was resting. The camels were peacefully lying down. The palms stood all round in a complete circle. All the party were at dinner. But he was drinking water from a spring which flowed gurgling close by. And it was so cool. It was wonderful. Wonderful blue cold water running among the party-colored stones and over the clean sand, which glistened here and there, like gold. Suddenly, he heard a clock strike. He started, roused himself, raised his head, looked out of the window, and seeing how late it was, suddenly jumped up, wide awake, as though someone had pulled him off the sofa. He crept on tiptoe to the door, stealthily opened it, and began listening on the staircase. His heart beat terribly. But all was quiet on the stairs, as if everyone was asleep. It seemed to him strange and monstrous that he could have slept in such forgetfulness from the previous day and had done nothing, had prepared nothing yet. And meanwhile, perhaps it had struck 6. And his drowsiness and stupefaction were followed by an extraordinary, feverish, as it were, distracted haste. But the preparations to be made were few. He concentrated all his energies on thinking of everything and forgetting nothing. And his heart kept beating and thumping so that he could hardly breathe. First, he had to make a noose and sew it into his overcoat, a work of a moment. He rummaged under his pillow and picked out amongst the linen stuffed away under it a worn-out old unwashed shirt. From its rags he tore a long strip, a couple of inches wide and about 16 inches long. He folded this strip in 2, took off his wide, strong summer overcoat of some stout cotton material, his only outer garment, and began sewing the 2 ends of the rag on the inside, under the left armhole. His hands shook as he sewed, but he did it successfully, so that nothing showed outside when he put the coat on again. The needle and thread he had got ready long before, and they lay on his table in a piece of paper. As for the noose, it was a very ingenious device of his own. The noose was intended for the axe. It was impossible for him to carry the axe through the street in his hands. And if hidden under his coat, he would still have had to support it with his hand, which would have been noticeable. Now, he had only to put the head of the axe in the noose, and it would hang quietly under his arm on the inside. Putting his hand in his coat pocket, he could hold the end of the handle all the way, so that it didn't swing. And as the coat was very full, a regular sack, in fact, it couldn't be seen from outside that he was holding something with the hand that was in the pocket. This noose, too, he had designed a fortnight before. When he had finished with this, he thrust his hand into a little opening between his sofa and the floor, fumbled in the left corner, and drew out the pledge, which he had got ready long before and hidden there. This pledge was, however, only a smoothly planed piece of wood, the size and thickness of a silver cigarette case. He picked up this piece of wood in one of his wanderings in a courtyard where there was some sort of a workshop. Afterwards he had added to the wood a thin, smooth piece of iron, which he had also picked up at the same time in the street. Putting the iron, which was a little the smaller, on the piece of wood, he fastened them very firmly, crossing and recrossing the thread round them, then wrapped them carefully and daintily in clean white paper, and tied up the parcel so that it would be very difficult to untie it. This was in order to divert the attention of the old woman for a time, while she was trying to undo the knot, and so to gain a moment. The iron strip was added to give weight, so that the woman might not guess the first minute that the thing was made of wood. All this had been stored by him beforehand under the sofa. He had only just got the pledge out, when he heard someone suddenly shout in the yard, "It struck six long ago!" Long ago! My God! He rushed to the door, listened, caught up his hat, and began to descend his 13 steps, cautiously, noiselessly, like a cat. He had still the most important thing to do, to steal the axe from the kitchen. That the deed must be done with an axe, he had decided long ago. He had also a pocket pruning knife, but he couldn't rely on the knife, and still less on his own strength, and so resolved, finally, on the axe. We may note in passing one peculiarity in regard to all the final resolutions taken by him in the matter. They had one strange characteristic. The more final they were, the more hideous and the more absurd they at once became in his eyes. In spite of all his agonizing inward struggle, he never for a single instant, all that time, could believe in the carrying out of his plans. And indeed, if it had ever happened that everything to the least point could have been considered and finally settled, and no uncertainty of any kind had remained, he would, it seems, have renounced it all as something absurd, monstrous, and impossible. But a whole mass of unsettled points and uncertainties remained. As for getting the axe, that trifling business cost him no anxiety, for nothing could be easier. Nastasya was continually out of the house, especially in the evenings. She would run in to the neighbors or to a shop, and always left the door ajar. It was the one thing the landlady was always scolding her about. And so, when the time came, he would only have to go quietly into the kitchen, and to take the axe, and an hour later, when everything was over, go in and put it back again. But these were doubtful points. Supposing he returned an hour later to put it back, and Nastasya had come back and was on the spot. He would, of course, have to go by and wait till she went out again. But supposing she were in the meantime to miss the axe, look for it, make an outcry. That would mean suspicion, or at least grounds for suspicion. But those were all trifles which he had not even begun to consider. And indeed he had no time. He was thinking of the chief point, and put off trifling details until he could believe in it all. but that seemed utterly unattainable. So it seemed to himself, at least. He couldn't imagine, for instance, that he would sometime leave off thinking, get up, and simply go there. Even his late experiment, that is, his visit with the object of a final survey of the place, was simply an attempt at an experiment. Far from being the real thing, as though one should say, come, let us go and try it, why dream about it? And at once he had broken down and had run away, cursing in a frenzy with himself. Meanwhile, it would seem, as regards the moral question, that his analysis was complete. His casuistry had become keen as a razor, and he couldn't find rational objections in himself. But in the last resort, he simply ceased to believe in himself, and doggedly, slavishly sought arguments in all directions, fumbling for them, as though someone were forcing and drawing him to it. At first, long before, indeed, he had been much occupied with one question. Why almost all crimes are so badly concealed and so easily detected? And why almost all criminals leave such obvious traces? He had come gradually to many different and curious conclusions. And, in his opinion, the chief reason lay not so much in the material impossibility of concealing the crime as in the criminal himself. Almost every criminal is subject to a failure of will and reasoning power by a childish and phenomenal heedlessness at the very instants when prudence and caution are most essential. It was his conviction that this eclipse of reason and failure of willpower attacked a man like a disease, developed gradually and reached its highest point just before the perpetration of the crime, continued with equal violence at the moment of the crime, and for longer or shorter time after, according to the individual case, and then passed off like any other disease. The question whether the disease gives rise to the crime, or whether the crime from its own peculiar nature is always accompanied by something of the nature of disease, he didn't yet feel able to decide. When he reached these conclusions, he decided that in his own case there could not be such a morbid reaction, that his reason and will would remain unimpaired at the time of carrying out his design, for the simple reason that his design was not a crime. We will omit all the process by means of which he arrived at this last conclusion. We have run too far ahead already. We may add only that the practical, purely material difficulties of the affair occupied a secondary position in his mind. One has but to keep all one's willpower and reason to deal with them, and they will all be overcome at the time when once one has familiarized oneself with the minutest details of the business. But this preparation had never been begun. His final decisions were what he came to trust least. And when the hour struck, it all came to pass quite differently, as it were accidentally and unexpectedly. One trifling circumstance upset his calculations before he had even left the staircase. When he reached the landlady's kitchen, the door of which was open, as usual, he glanced cautiously in to see whether, in Nastasya's absence, the landlady herself was there, or if not, whether the door to her own room was closed, so that she might not peep out when he went in for the axe. But what was his amazement when he suddenly saw that Nastasya was not only at home in the kitchen, but was occupied there, taking linen out of a basket and hanging it on a line. Seeing him, she left off hanging the clothes, turned to him, and stared at him all the time he was passing. He turned away his eyes, and walked past as though he noticed nothing. But it was the end of everything. He had not the axe. He was overwhelmed. "What made me think," he reflected, as he went under the gateway, "what made me think that she would be sure not to be at home at that moment? Why did I assume this so certainly?" He was crushed, and even humiliated. He could have laughed at himself in his anger. A dull, animal rage boiled within him. He stood hesitating in the gateway. To go into the street, to go for a walk for appearance sake, was revolting. To go back to his room, even more revolting. "And what a chance I have lost forever," he muttered, standing aimlessly in the gateway, just opposite the porter's little dark room, which was also open. Suddenly, he started. From the porter's room, 2 paces away from him, something shining under the bench to the right caught his eye. He looked about him. Nobody. He approached the room on tiptoe, went down 2 steps into it, and in a faint voice called the porter. Yes, not at home. Somewhere near, though, in the yard, for the door is wide open. He dashed to the axe. It was an axe, and pulled it out from under the bench, where it lay between 2 chunks of wood. At once, before going out, he made it fast in the noose. He thrust both hands into his pockets and went out of the room. No one had noticed him. "When reason fails, the devil helps," he thought with a strange grin. This chance raised his spirits extraordinarily. He walked along quietly and sedately, without hurry, to avoid awakening suspicion. He scarcely looked at the passers-by, tried to escape looking at their faces at all, and to be as little noticeable as possible. Suddenly, he thought of his hat. Good heavens! I had the money the day before yesterday and did not get a cap to wear instead. A curse rose from the bottom of his soul. Glancing out of the corner of his eye into a shop, he saw by a clock on the wall that it was 7:10. He had to make haste, and at the same time to go some way round so as to approach the house from the other side. When he had happened to imagine all this beforehand, he had sometimes thought that he would be very much afraid, but he was not very much afraid now. Was not afraid at all. Indeed. His mind was even occupied by irrelevant matters, but by nothing for long. As he passed the Yusupov garden, he was deeply absorbed in considering the building of great fountains and of their refreshing effect on the atmosphere in all the squares. By degrees he passed to the conviction that if the summer garden were extended to the field of Mars, and perhaps joined to the garden of the Mikhailovsky Palace, it would be a splendid thing and a great benefit to the town. Then he was interested by the question why in all great towns men are not simply driven by necessity, but in some peculiar way inclined to live in those parts of the town where there are no gardens nor fountains, where there is most dirt and smell and all sorts of nastiness. Then his own walks through the Haymarket came back to his mind, and for a moment he waked up to reality. What nonsense, he thought. Better think of nothing at all. So probably men led to execution clutch mentally at every object that meets them on the way, flashed through his mind, but simply flashed, like lightning. He made haste to dismiss this thought. And by now he was near. Here was the house. Here was the gate. Suddenly a clock somewhere struck once. What? Can it be 7:30? Impossible. It must be fast. Luckily for him, everything went well again at the gates. At that very moment, as though expressly for his benefit, a huge wagon of hay had just driven in at the gate, completely screening him as he passed under the gateway. And the wagon had scarcely had time to drive through into the yard before he had slipped in a flash to the right. On the other side of the wagon he could hear shouting and quarreling, but no one noticed him, and no one met him. Many windows looking into that huge quadrangular yard were open at that moment, but he didn't raise his head. He hadn't the strength to. The staircase leading to the old woman's room was close by, just on the right of the gateway. He was already on the stairs. Drawing a breath, pressing his hand against his throbbing heart, and once more feeling for the axe and setting it straight, he began softly and cautiously ascending the stairs, listening every minute. But the stairs, too, were quite deserted. All the doors were shut. He met no one. One flat, indeed, on the first floor was wide open, and painters were at work in it, but they didn't glance at him. He stood still, thought a minute, and went on. Of course it would be better if they hadn't been here, but it's two stories above them. And here was the fourth story. Here was the door. Here was the flat opposite, the empty one. The flat underneath the old woman's was apparently empty also. The visiting card nailed on the door had been torn off. They had gone away. He was out of breath. For one instant, the thought floated through his mind, "Shall I go back?" But he made no answer, and began listening at the old woman's door. A dead silence. Then he listened again on the staircase, listened long and intently, then looked about him for the last time, pulled himself together, drew himself up, and once more tried the axe in the noose. "Am I very pale?" he wondered. "Am I not evidently agitated? She is mistrustful. Had I better wait a little longer, till my heart leaves off thumping?" But his heart did not leave off. On the contrary, as though to spite him, it throbbed more and more violently. He could stand it no longer. He slowly put out his hand to the bell and rang. Half a minute later, he rang again, more loudly. No answer. To go on ringing was useless and out of place. The old woman was, of course, at home, but she was suspicious and alone. He had some knowledge of her habits, and once more he put his ear to the door. Either his senses were peculiarly keen, which it's difficult to suppose, or the sound was really very distinct. Anyway, he suddenly heard something like the cautious touch of a hand on the lock, and the rustle of a skirt at the very door. Someone was standing stealthily close to the lock, and just as he was doing on the outside, was secretly listening within, and seemed to have her ear to the door. He moved a little on purpose and muttered something aloud that he might not have the appearance of hiding, then rang a third time, but quietly, soberly, and without impatience. Recalling it afterwards, that moment stood out in his mind vividly, distinctly, forever. He couldn't make out how he had had such cunning, for his mind was, as it were, clouded at moments, and he was almost unconscious of his body. An instant later, he heard the latch unfastened. Chapter 7. The door was, as before, opened a tiny crack. And again, two sharp and suspicious eyes stared at him out of the darkness. Then Raskolnikov lost his head and nearly made a great mistake. Fearing the old woman would be frightened by their being alone, and not hoping that the sight of him would disarm her suspicions, he took hold of the door and drew it towards him to prevent the old woman from attempting to shut it again. Seeing this, she did not pull the door back, but she did not let go the handle so that he almost dragged her out with it onto the stairs. Seeing that she was standing in the doorway, not allowing him to pass, he advanced straight upon her. She stepped back in alarm, tried to say something, but seemed unable to speak, and stared with open eyes at him. "Good evening, Alyona Ivanovna," he began, trying to speak easily, but his voice would not obey him. It broke and shook. I have brought something. But we'd better come in to the light." And leaving her, he passed straight into the room uninvited. The old woman ran after him. Her tongue was unloosed.
"Good heavens! What is it? Who is it? What do you want?"
"Why, Alyona Ivanovna, you know me. Raskolnikov. Here. I brought you the pledge I promised the other day." And he held out the pledge. The old woman glanced for a moment at the pledge, but at once stared in the eyes of her uninvited visitor. She looked intently, maliciously, and mistrustfully. A minute passed. He even fancied something like a sneer in her eyes, as though she had already guessed everything. He felt that he was losing his head, that he was almost frightened, so frightened that if she were to look like that and not say a word for another half minute, he thought he would have run away from her. "Why do you look at me as though you didn't know me?" he said suddenly, also with malice. "Take it if you like. If not, I'll go elsewhere. I'm in a hurry." He had not even thought of saying this, but it was suddenly said of itself. The old woman recovered herself, and her visitor's resolute tone evidently restored her confidence.
"But why, my good sir, all of a minute? What is it?"
she asked, looking at the pledge. "The silver cigarette case. I spoke of it last time, you know." She held out her hand.
"But how pale you are, to be sure. And your hands are trembling, too."
"Fever," he answered abruptly. "You can't help getting pale if you've nothing to eat," he added, with difficulty articulating the words. His strength was failing him again. But his answer sounded like the truth. The old woman took the pledge.
"What is it?"
she asked, once more, scanning Raskolnikov intently and weighing the pledge in her hand. "A thing. Cigarette case. Silver. Look at it."
"It doesn't seem somehow like silver. How he has wrapped it up!"
Trying to untie the string, and turning to the window, to the light, all her windows were shut in spite of the stifling heat, she left him altogether for some seconds, and stood with her back to him. He unbuttoned his coat, and freed the axe from the noose, but didn't yet take it out altogether, simply holding it in his right hand under the coat. His hands were fearfully weak. He felt them every moment growing more numb and more wooden. He was afraid he would let the axe slip and fall. A sudden giddiness came over him.
"But what has he tied it up like this for?" the old woman cried with vexation and moved towards him.
He hadn't a minute more to lose. He pulled the axe quite out, swung it with both arms, scarcely conscious of himself, and almost without effort, almost mechanically, brought the blunt side down on her head. He seemed not to use his own strength in this. But as soon as he had once brought the axe down, his strength returned to him. The old woman was as always bareheaded. Her thin, light hair, streaked with grey, thickly smeared with grease, was braided in a rat's tail and fastened by a broken horn comb which stood out on the nape of her neck. As she was so short, the blow fell on the very top of her skull. She cried out, but very faintly, and suddenly sank, all of a heap on the floor, raising her hands to her head. In one hand she still held the pledge. Then he dealt her another, and another blow with a blunt side, and on the same spot. The blood gushed, as from an overturned glass. The body fell back. He stepped back, let it fall, and at once bent over her face. She was dead. Her eyes seemed to be starting out of their sockets. The brow and the whole face were drawn and contorted convulsively. He laid the axe on the ground near the dead body, and felt at once in her pocket, trying to avoid the streaming blood, the same right-hand pocket from which she had taken the key on his last visit. He was in full possession of his faculties, free from confusion or giddiness, but his hands were still trembling. He remembered afterwards that he had been particularly collected and careful, trying all the time not to get smeared with blood. He pulled out the keys at once. They were all, as before, in one bunch on a steel ring. He ran at once into the bedroom with them. It was a very small room with a whole shrine of holy images. Against the other wall stood a big bed, very clean, and covered with a silk patchwork wadded quilt. Against a third wall was a chest of drawers. Strange to say, so soon as he began to fit the keys into the chest, so soon as he heard their jingling, a convulsive shudder passed over him. He suddenly felt tempted again to give it all up and go away. But that was only for an instant. It was too late to go back. He positively smiled at himself, when suddenly another terrifying idea occurred to his mind. He suddenly fancied that the old woman might be still alive and might recover her senses. Leaving the keys in the chest, he ran back to the body, snatched up the axe, and lifted it once more over the old woman, but didn't bring it down. There was no doubt that she was dead. Bending down and examining her again more closely, he saw clearly that the skull was broken and even battered in on one side. He was about to feel it with his finger, but drew back his hand, and indeed it was evident without that. Meanwhile, there was a perfect pool of blood. All at once he noticed a string on her neck. He tugged at it, but the string was strong and didn't snap, and besides, it was soaked with blood. He tried to pull it out from the front of the dress, but something held it and prevented its coming. In his impatience, he raised the axe again to cut the string from above on the body, but didn't dare, and with difficulty, smearing his hand and the axe in the blood, after 2 minutes' hurried effort, he cut the string and took it off without touching the body with the axe. He wasn't mistaken, it was a purse. On the string were 2 crosses, one of cypress wood and one of copper, and an image in silver filigree, and with them a small, greasy, chamois leather purse with a steel rim and ring. The purse was stuffed very full. Raskolnikov thrust it in his pocket without looking at it, flung the crosses on the old woman's body, and rushed back into the bedroom, this time taking the axe with him. He was in terrible haste. He snatched the keys and began trying them again, but he was unsuccessful. They wouldn't fit in the locks. It wasn't so much that his hands were shaking, but that he kept making mistakes. Though he saw, for instance, that a key was not the right one and would not fit, still he tried to put it in. Suddenly he remembered and realized that the big key with the deep notches, which was hanging there with the small keys, could not possibly belong to the chest of drawers. On his last visit this had struck him, but to some strong box, and that everything, perhaps, was hidden in that box. He left the chest of drawers, and at once felt under the bedstead, knowing that old women usually keep boxes under their beds. And so it was. There was a good-sized box under the bed, at least a yard in length, with an arched lid covered with red leather and studded with steel nails. The notched key fitted at once and unlocked it. At the top, under a white sheet, was a coat of red brocade lined with hareskin. Under it was a silk dress, then a shawl, and it seemed as though there was nothing below but clothes. The first thing he did was to wipe his blood-stained hands on the red brocade. It's red, and on red blood will be less noticeable. The thought passed through his mind. Then he suddenly came to himself. Good God! Am I going out of my senses? He thought with terror. But no sooner did he touch the clothes than a gold watch slipped from under the fur coat. He made haste to turn them all over. There turned out to be various articles made of gold among the clothes. Probably all pledges. Unredeemed or waiting to be redeemed. Bracelets, chains, earrings, pins, and such things. Some were in cases, others simply wrapped in newspaper, carefully and exactly folded, and tied round with tape. Without any delay, he began filling up the pockets of his trousers and overcoat without examining or undoing the parcels and cases. But he had not time to take many. He suddenly heard steps in the room where the old woman lay. He stopped short and was still as death. But all was quiet. So it must have been his fancy. All at once, he heard distinctly a faint cry, as though someone had uttered a low, broken moan. Then again, dead silence for a minute or two. He sat, squatting on his heels by the box, and waited, holding his breath. Suddenly, he jumped up, seized the axe, and ran out of the bedroom. In the middle of the room stood Lizaveta, with a big bundle in her arms. She was gazing in stupefaction at her murdered sister, white as a sheet and seeming not to have the strength to cry out. Seeing him run out of the bedroom, she began faintly quivering all over like a leaf. A shudder ran down her face. She lifted her hand, opened her mouth, but still did not scream. She began slowly backing away from him into the corner, staring intently, persistently at him, but still uttered no sound, as though she couldn't get breath to scream. He rushed at her with the axe. Her mouth twitched piteously, as one sees babies' mouths when they begin to be frightened, stare intently at what frightens them, and are on the point of screaming. And this hapless Lizaveta was so simple, and had been so thoroughly crushed and scared, that she didn't even raise a hand to guard her face, though that was the most necessary and natural action at the moment, for the axe was raised over her face. She only put up her empty left hand, but not to her face, slowly holding it out before her as though motioning him away. The axe fell with the sharp edge just on the skull and split at one blow all the top of the head. She fell heavily at once. Raskolnikov completely lost his head, snatched up her